Welcome to the latest episode of the Catalyst Health and Wellness Coaching Podcast. My name is Bradford Cooper, and I will be your host. How does your perspective on the things you're facing in life influence the outcome? Well, there are clearly many answers to that question, but today we'll take a deeper dive into at least a part of the answer to that question. Our guest is Dr. Adrian Heise. Dr. Heise and I met when we were both speaking at a psychology conference in Germany earlier this year. I was fascinated by the information he shared and frankly thought you would be too. When I mentioned the possibility of joining us on the podcast, he graciously agreed. Dr. Heise grew up in Germany and then moved to the Netherlands to pursue his bachelor's and master's degrees in psychology and behavioral social sciences. He then moved to the UK, where he earned his PhD in sport and exercise psychology at the University of Essex. He is passionate about cycling, music, and politics, but don't worry, we kept the conversation focused on the psychology and behavioral sciences. As you know, our focus on evidence-based practices means we invite quite a few researchers to join us on the podcast. We want to help you cut through the fads, take a deeper dive into the evidence, and I think you'll be fascinated by the practical aspects of today's discussion, especially the information he shares about how motivational versus instructional self-talk can be extremely effective in some situations and yet essentially worthless in others. If you're looking to pursue your wellness coach certification, our last fast track of the year is coming up November 9th and 10th in Colorado. All the details are available at catalystcoachinginstitute.com. And if you'd like to have us come to you, we have done that recently. Feel free to reach out to us and we can talk through details. If you have any other questions about the National Board Certification, your career, really anything coaching related, you can email us anytime at results@catalystcoachinginstitute.com. Thanks for joining us. Now let's pick up with Dr. Adrian Heise discussing challenge, threat, and the impact of the various forms of self-talk on this episode of the Catalyst Health and Wellness Coaching Podcast. Well, Dr. Heise, it's great to have you join us. We had a chance to meet at the FEPSAC conference when we were both speaking. So thanks for jumping on board.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, set the tone here a little bit. Share with us a little bit about why or how you developed an interest in this concept of challenge threat states.
All right. So I was, my dad's a psychiatrist and he talks a lot about stress medicine and I've had a bit of an influence from that side. And I got into the specific challenge and threat theory stuff when I was looking for a PhD or for a PhD vacancy. And I found this advertised vacancy in Essex where it was about challenge and threat states and athletes. And I read up the little description that it said, and I thought, well, this is really interesting. And this is really a nice way to look at stress responses. So when I thought, okay, I'm going to apply to this and hopefully I'll get accepted. And I did get accepted. So that's when I started my challenge and threat journey. And I learned a lot about the theory, and there's a lot of interesting empirical research that supported this theory.
Yeah, we interviewed Dr. Carla Mann almost a year ago, and she did her PhD work on challenge threat as well. It's fascinating information. Had you, as you read through it initially, had you seen this taking place in your life, either in athletics or academia or personal connections? Did it resonate with you on a personal level, or was it just a curiosity on an academic level?
Yeah, of course. I mean, when you read the theory, it all seems familiar in a way, because everybody knows the situation where they have the stress response where they feel really inhibited by it and they feel like this is a negative feeling and it just feels threatening everything about the situation. And then people usually also know situations where it's really kind of a big deal what you have to do, but you just you get a more adaptive state where you deal with a task that you have to perform much better, and you really just focus on the goal and perform, and then that's it. So I think it resonates with me it resonated with me because I've been in those kind of situations many times, as probably everybody has.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, okay, so without taking us into too deep a dive in the world of academia, can you share with our audience essentially what is challenge threat and where they might see these states occurring in their own lives or the people around them?
Yeah, okay, so there's this theory on challenge and threat states, and it basically evolved from two the strands of literature. One of them is cognitive appraisal theory, and one of them is the physiological toughness literature. And it basically combines these research areas and says that in any self-relevant performance situation where we have to perform adequately to reach, to attain a relevant goal that is important for our continued development or well-being, in those situations, we have a continuum of stress responses that ranges from a threat to a challenge state. And these stress responses start in the way we evaluate the situation. And the crucial distinction compared to the cognitive appraisal literature is that the biopsychosocial model of challenge and threat says that we make these evaluations consciously or subconsciously. So it says that in any important performance situation, these evaluations happen and we can be aware of them or we cannot be aware of them. And depending on how these evaluations are made, we arrive at a state where we experience a challenge or a threat. And that's determined by the balance of resources that we see in ourselves and the demands that we see in this performance situation. So basically, if we evaluate our resources to match or outweigh the demands of the situation, we experience a challenge state. But if we evaluate our resources to fall short of the situational demands, then we experience a threat state. And that's where the physiological toughness literature comes in, which is based on a lot of animal research. So that's where we these evaluations then trigger a set of physiological responses, and they're mostly described on the cardiovascular level, where the cardiovascular system starts a response that is contingent on the performance situation and also contingent on what evaluations we make. So when we have a challenge evaluation, our cardiovascular system functions more efficiently and it pumps more blood, but it also dilates the blood vessels in the periphery so that the blood is then distributed more easily throughout the body. And that is basically understood as a way of increasing the energy efficiency or right. The efficiency of the blood distribution.
Yeah,
and in a threat state, we also have a mild increase in cardiac output, so more blood pumped per minute, but we have a constriction of the blood vessels, which basically means that we have cardiovascular strain because the heart and the vasculature work against each other. And there's Jim Blaskovich, the main author of the theory, made the point that in the long run, if you experience this many times, this can be harmful to your cardiovascular system, and that cardiovascular diseases can result from that. But in the short term, it's also been associated with performance. But
I'm sorry for interrupting you. So not only is performance dropped down, but you actually have some health issues that can result from that when that's constantly seen as a threat over extended periods of time.
Yeah, exactly. And that's something where Blaskovich wrote a big book chapter called Challenge, Threat, and Health. And that's really interesting to look at, but that has not been studied as as far as the performance side of it. So while we have a lot of research that shows that a challenge state relates to better performance than a threat state, we don't have so much research testing the health outcomes of challenge and threat states. And that's more difficult to test because, of course, you need to test over longer periods of time.
Right.
Yeah. But over Yeah, there have been a lot of studies that tested short-term outcomes that can be indicative of longer-term changes when they are repeated. And that's what Blaskovich summarized in his book chapter. And basically, he says that a threat state, when experienced repeatedly or too intensely, it can produce not only cardiovascular problems, but also mental health problems like depression and anxiety. And it can also produce immune problems because a threat state has also been associated with a cortisol release. And we probably all know that that is not very good for the body
Over
if you
extended
keep it
periods.
chronically.
Right. Okay. So it's your interpretation of you look at all the things that you have kind of going for you and all the things going against you, and you line those up. This is simplicity, obviously. And you say, uh-oh, I don't have enough. Now, how much of that is interpretation and how much? Because you see the same two people facing the same situation with essentially the same skill set, background, history, experience, et cetera. One person sees it as a challenge, the other person sees it as a threat, where it's all about the interpretation. How big a role does that play in how this rolls itself out in life?
I mean, it's quite important because there have been a couple of studies by Dr. Lee Moore, who I've collaborated with in the past, who has manipulated just the instructions to a task that participants had to perform in the laboratory. And the task was exactly the same for everybody. It's just that half the sample got challenge instructions and half the sample got threat instructions. And he found that the people with the challenge instructions not only displayed a cardiovascular response more consistent with their challenge state, but they also outperformed the other participants. And they had reasonably large groups, so that it was they basically could conclude that it was these instructions, which was the only difference between groups, that made people underperform or perform at a high level.
So that's really interesting. Can you give us an example of maybe the difference between the challenge instructions and the threat instructions that made that kind of a difference, not only in performance, but in the interpretation?
Yeah, so in Dr. Moore's 2013 publication, he basically wrote that the challenge instructions encourage participants to perceive the task as a challenge to be met and overcome, and to think of themselves as someone capable of meeting that challenge, and highlighted that previous participants had performed well on the task. In contrast, the threat instructions focused on the task's high degree of difficulty and emphasized that previous participants had struggled to perform well on the task.
Wow. So folks listening to this, especially if you're a wellness coach or you're heading that way, think of that in your con in the context of what you're doing on a daily basis. If you help your clients see the opportunity, see that this is a challenge, see that they can reach it, see where their opportunities are to draw from. Think of the difference in the outcome. Think of the difference in their overall perspective versus the other side of saying, well, you know, this is going to be really tough and I don't know if you can do it. So incredible application of what we're talking about every day. This is great stuff. Dr. Hazel, why does the personal interpretation between the two, just expanding on what we just talked about, why does the personal interpretation between the two matter to us in everyday life?
Yeah, because basically these challenge and threat states occur in all the situations that are important for us, for our career or just for our well-being. We always have motivated performance situations that we have to master to keep on while developing or to keep sustaining a good mood. And I think it's important to know about these stress responses just so you can be aware of a threat state when it occurs. And basically, you can tell yourself, okay, look, I'm feeling bad and I might underperform, but this is not something out of the ordinary. Everybody can experience this and it's a continuum. So it's not like everything is lost. If I try hard to regulate my emotions now or to focus on the target now, I can at least get a little better. And I think oftentimes people tend to, or some people some people tend to catastrophize when they are in a negative stress response, and they tend to say, okay, that this is it. There's no way I'm going to win this. And I think it's very important to be able to differentiate. I think knowledge of the theory of challenge and threat states helps with that.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think just knowing that this exists can change the way you approach anything. So you're saying this, just to be clear, we're not just talking about athletes here. We're talking about anything. It can be a relationship with your teenager. It can be the way you approach that bill that comes in the mail today. It can be the request from your boss. This could be any aspect of life. Am I hearing you correctly?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've done my PhD in sports psychology, but a lot of the research in the literature is done with undergraduate students, because that's very common in academia anyway. Sure. And but also there have been studies using pilots or using medical students with surgery tasks. Or there's been a study by Dr. Mark Seary on university students having a course exam, and people with a challenge state had a better grade than people in a threat state on the final course outcomes. So. Wow. Yeah, it's not at all just restricted to sports, but it can be any important performance situation. And the biopsychosocial model of challenge and threat basically defines these situations as situations where you have a self-relevant goal on the line. There's some sort of evaluative standard. And there's some sort of standard that you have to perform at or surpass in order to attain your goal. And that can be many different situations.
I love it. I love it. All right. Your research was on the concept of self-talk. So let's set that stage a little bit. Can you tell us about the various types of self-talk and how we may want to use that in the different aspects of our lives?
Yeah. So there's been an entire literature on self-talk, and there are many different types of self-talk that have been described. For instance, positive has been separated from negative self-talk. There's organic self-talk versus strategic self-talk. So more naturally occurring self-talk. I mean, everybody knows that sometimes we just say things to ourselves in our heads or out loud. That's also another distinction, whether it's silent or audible. And there is the distinction of motivational and instructional self-talk. And I've dedicated a study of my PhD to that, to testing whether relative to a controlled self-talk intervention, whether strategic motivational or strategic instructional self-talk put people in a challenge state. Because basically what we've found in the literature is that the effects of motivational and instructional self-talk and those of a challenge state overlap considerably. So they are both associated with improved performance, and they're associated with more facilitative interpretations of anxiety. And there's been this overlap that we found that was really asking a question or begging the question of, does the intervention of motivational or instructional self-talk promote a challenge state in people?
So self-talk, just like the challenge threat concept, self-talk is not just something for athletes. Can you throw some other ideas out about how people could use it on a practical level in their daily lives?
Yeah, I mean, basically, I think we also, we all use self-talk in the daily tasks that we do. And sometimes it might not be goal-directed and not relevant, but other times it might be relevant to a goal that we're trying to achieve. And it might be that self-talk is a hindrance or helps us put on a good performance, but it's definitely something that you could implement in your office job or in an academic context. It's not something that is just limited to sports. Yeah, instructional self-talk is defined by the content, or these types are defined by the content of the self-talk. So we can either say something that is relevant to how you execute the task that you have to do and technical information. Or you can do, you can, what you probably know as pushing yourself or hyping yourself, you can say something more motivational and try to maximize your effort and your motivation to perform well.
Any findings around, and this is a little bit of a stretch, but I'm just going to throw it out for grins. Any findings that using something too frequently begins to lose its effects? So for example, motivational self-talk. Come on, Brad, you got this. You can do this. Come on, you can do. If I'm using that, you know, 12 times throughout the day instead of just for that one big one that I need to pull it out, have you found that it loses its effectiveness when you're using it too much? Whereas maybe instructional self-talk is effective over time. It doesn't wear down. Any distinction between those two in terms of frequency of use or when you pull it out of your pocket to put into play?
I'm not sure about that. I think what's more important is that it's appropriate to the context. So what we found in our study was that motivational and instructional self-talk didn't have a main effect on challenge and threat states, but they had an interaction with challenge and threat states on performance, which means that when someone was in a threat state and received the instructional self-talk instructions, they had an easier time performing on the level of other people in the instructional self-talk group who got who were in the challenge state. So instructional self-talk appeared to reduce the differences between a threat and a challenge state, thus either helping those in a threat state or making those in a challenge state worse. But I think the plausible interpretation would be that someone in a threat state is not really focused on the targets, on relevant cues, and instructional self-talk helps them refocus on relevant cues that they need to focus on. And conversely, the motivational self-talk group had bigger differences between a threat and a challenged participant, threatened and a challenged participant, relative to the control self-talk group, where it seems that if you tell someone in a threat state to use motivational self-talk, or maybe even if you as a coach give them motivational self-talk, motivational cues, that might not be as effective, because when you're feeling bad, you don't want to say to yourself, "Oh, I'm good. I can do this. I'm gonna make it." But maybe you just think, "Okay, I'm feeling really bad, but let's just focus on this and this, and let's just see that I get my swing right, or whatever technical instruction you might need." So we found that in the motivational self-talk group, relative to the control self-talk group, the differences were exacerbated between a challenge and a threat state. So that's something that coaches might want to keep in mind. So it's not so much that a cue can be overused, but rather that it might be misused in a certain situation.
Wow. All right. So let me re-say that to make sure I'm getting the message here, because this sounds like a key element. If I'm in that challenge state,
yeah,
then the motivational self-talk can be effective. Nothing's always effective, but it can be effective in that state. If I'm already kind of flipped the switch and I'm in that threat state, I'm kind of, you know, struggling through that. At that point, the instructional is far more valuable on average than the motivational self-talk or coach-directed talk. Is that right?
Yeah, that's about the main message that we got from that study. Wow. And I mean, what we did find was that motivational self-talk had a main effect. There was a main effect for self-talk where motivational self-talk was better than the control self-talk. So it has a general positive effect. But the effect of instructional self-talk appeared to be more important for threatened participants, whereas motivational self-talk appeared to be very beneficial for challenged participants, and then less so for threatened participants, even though there was a main effect showing that it was effective for everybody.
That is really powerful. That's That's a message that we need to get out there, because you know coaches are, you know, standing on the sidelines and their athletes are struggling. They're like, oh, come on, you got this, come on. And that's sounds like that's the wrong message at that moment. It's not the wrong message. It's the wrong message at that moment.
Exactly.
Wow. Very cool. Very cool. All right, let's flip the mirror around a little bit. We're turning to you a little bit. How has the research that you've gone through, and you've been fully submerged in it for several years, how has that influenced you personally? In what ways are you utilizing your knowledge of self-talk or challenge threat in your own life, not just as a researcher, but in things that you're doing differently on a daily basis in relationships or athletics or career pursuits or whatever it might be?
Yeah, so I really like cycling. I cycle a lot, or cycling is my favorite sport for exercising. And I know the feeling of, you know, you approach a climb or something and you just don't see yourself excelling or going fast over it. And I think it's that the research or the literature has helped me to recognize this thought and this bad stress state, and to say, okay, you're just going to push yourself through this. It doesn't have to be a fine performance. It doesn't have to be excellent, but this is normal. And even though we feel bad today, just pushing yourself on this climb will maybe have a good effect tomorrow or in a week from now, just as training. So I think it definitely helped me analyze my arousal differently, or my emotions in a sporting situation, and also in other situations. It's given me a much more neutral or objective look on motivated performance situations where I might not feel very well. But I know that also through the research of other researchers, that, for instance, arousal reappraisal can be very helpful with that, where you recognize the feelings or the physiological arousal that you have that feels uncomfortable, and then say, look, this is natural. This is an indicator that you take the situation seriously, and you can use this to your advantage. And especially in sporting situations where your body needs to be, you need to hit the on switch on your body, and you need to go in an active mode. So in those situations, it's not bad to have a high heart rate. It just shows you that your body is ready to perform. The challenge and threat research has helped me with that. The self-talk research as well. I mean, right. I try to, when I really notice myself saying negative things, I try to be aware of that and maybe reframe it as something more constructive. Yeah, as we mentioned earlier, it's very good to be aware of these things. I think that's already the first step forward.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think just someone just hearing this interview with you on their next run or interaction with someone or request from a boss, they'll be more effective at that self-reflection of saying, okay, hang on, 10 seconds, am I in a threat or a challenge state here? And what does that mean going forward? So like you say, just the knowledge of it can change the outcome in subtle ways.
Yeah.
Interesting. All right. So a lot of folks in our audience are either health and wellness coaches or they're heading in that direction. So let's talk through a potential example that would fit into that arena. Let's say someone's looking to make healthier food choices more regularly in their life. How could they utilize either the challenge threat perspective you've talked about and or the self-talk strategies to improve their outcomes in terms of those healthier food choices?
Food choices are something very interesting, because a lot of us make these choices on a very impulsive basis. And myself included, I just kind of feel the urge to buy unhealthy things every now and then.
Sure.
And, I mean, that's not bad every now and then, but if you want to change your habits in that sense, you could definitely use the challenge and threats research to your advantage, where if you find yourself eating something unhealthy and giving in to your urges, you could say, okay, this is not the end. This is just me being, your reaction afterwards might be, that of a threat state where you feel like you're failing, and you feel like you're just not, you just don't have enough resources to cope with the demands of the of this goal pursuit of changing your diet. And in that situation, yeah, you could say, look, this is not the end of it all. It's just a tiny dip in performance, but it can get back up there. And others, I mean, just like these instructions that they've used in the experimental research, you can appeal to your resources by saying, look, others have done the same thing before me. This is nothing revolutionary, but others have had the same struggle and it's difficult, but I have the resources to overcome this. And believing that the demands are too high is just a fallacy, or it's not true. So yeah, we could use the instructional framing to help people who are looking to make healthier food choices. We could use the self-talk research as well by saying, maybe if someone is struggling, maybe we give them instructional instructions. Teach them an instructional self-talk cue where if they go to the grocery store, they say, okay, it has to have zero sugar. Like, just use zero sugar as the cue for buying things. Look at the, you know, look at the label and see if it has zero sugar. I mean, whatever the goals are, and I'm sure that the professionals, the health and wellness professionals, they will have small goals that they try to implement with their clients. I think that they can remind the clients of those small goals or the steps to take towards those small goals and turn them into instructional self-talk cues if the clients are struggling.
Now, in terms of the training aspect of this, you mentioned Dr. Moore's studies. It was literally on-the-spot instructions going into the study. You and I talked about the fact that just the knowledge of, the understanding that the challenge threat exists, the value of instructional versus motivational self-talk is differentiated. Have you seen any patterns of, look, Brad, it's a 5-minute training thing. It's, or have you seen that people get better at it as you do it daily for 2 weeks? Anything you're aware of that might give us a sense of when the training in challenge threat and self-talk starts to level out? Is it pretty quick once they have an understanding of it?
When we published our self-talk article, we got the feedback that we should have had a longer self-talk training period. So I think with self-talk, I think it takes a good while. So people would usually say a couple of weeks to train this to really to get more effective. So I think this is really something that people should use habitually, where they shouldn't think about it. Because of course it draws on cognitive resources if people have to think or focus on verbalizing the self-talk cues in a performance situation. But if you've practiced it for a couple of weeks and practiced it so much that it's fully internalized or automatized, then I think, there might be a plateau where it's effective, but it doesn't get any more effective. But I think it takes a good time, a good bit of time to get its maximum effects. And I think it should be, the focus should be on getting it fully automatized so that the client doesn't have to think about these things anymore, but just automatically says an instructional cue or a motivational cue in certain situations.
Okay, so let's talk about cueing for a second. One of my PhD studies looked at self-talk related to mental toughness levels, and most of the athletes would sit there and tell you, I know I should be using self-talk. I believe in it. I understand the value of it. And I get in that mile race, I get in that 5K, and I forget. Are there certain cues that in the moment when the intensity is on, the spotlight's going, that you found can be helpful in reminding folks? Or let's take it out of athletics and, you know, your teenage daughter says something and you're like, it's driving me crazy, that you immediately remember the self-talk, you remember the challenge. Hey, I love my daughter. I want to have a relationship, and start using that self-talk versus just responding. Have you seen any ways to effectively cue it in the midst of the endorphins kicking in and the pressure's on and those kinds of things?
I don't really know about that, but I would say if an athlete says that they forget about it in the important performance situation, that's something that can happen. But in that case, I would just say keep on training, keep on practicing it. And at some point you won't forget anymore. Yeah, I would just recommend to keep on practicing it. And maybe at a not so important competition, be a bit more focused on practicing the self-talk cue. So maybe if you have a regional competition that's not so important, maybe you can say, okay, I will focus on getting the self-talk cue right, and then I'll focus on the competition. Whereas if you have a really important competition, it might be that you can't afford to focus on it. But I think, yeah, you can probably move continuously from training with absolutely no competitive pressure to the most important competition with the maximum pressure. And you could practice the self-talk cues throughout the different stages of competition or training.
Okay, good, good. All right, just a couple more. Whatever message you come up with about health and wellness in your research, what, you know, the consistency between the two will magically appear on everybody's cell phone home screen. What would it say? What would be that one sentence or one phrase that you'd want to share with the world if you had the opportunity related to your background, your research?
Well, it would be a long message, but get to the books or get to the internet and read about scientific findings first. Yeah, I guess it sounds cliche or it sounds cheesy, but impossible is nothing is a very good attitude to have, even though it's not true. I mean, some things are impossible, but I really like the slogan. I think it was Adidas back in the day who used that as an advertising slogan. And that really should be your attitude when training and when trying to perform, because oftentimes the mind is really the most important limiting factor in your performance. Of course, there are some limits to your body.
Sure.
But oftentimes our mind makes us believe that those limits are much lower than they actually are. So,
you know, let's spin off that for a second. One of the focal areas, one of the things we try to emphasize in this podcast is the evidence-based practices. So much in health and wellness is often the deep end, you know, it's just crazy stuff. It's headlines, it's fads, that kind of stuff. And so I like what you said about get into the research. How can someone who's not in academia, how can someone who hasn't spent 3, 4, 5, 6 years pursuing a PhD, what's practical advice would you have for them to dig into the research while avoiding just the headlines that are out there?
Yeah, so there are some nice resources out there on the internet. For instance, for dietary choices or dietary supplements, I really like examine.com, because they have a free database on basically all the dietary supplements you can think of and what scientific evidence there is behind them. And they make a nice overview with a table usually saying what outcome variables are there and how were they affected by the supplement. And I guess that there are more resources like this out there on the internet. Of course, not everybody can, not everybody has access to those scientific journals, and they're really expensive to read usually. Luckily, there are open access journals like Plus One nowadays, yeah, which everybody can read. So I recommend just getting into those, and sometimes just a review article or the introduction section to an article will tell you a lot about what's been done previously in the science world. Apart from that, stay skeptical. I mean, usually just try to look at the incentive system behind a product or behind a system, because usually it's quite easy to figure out whether a company has money to make off of a certain product. And if only that company says, oh, there's scientific support for our product, but then if you Google that supplement or whatever it is and nothing else comes up, then of course you can be a bit more skeptical than if you go onto a third-party website like examine.com and then find, okay, there's actually been 10 studies done and 6 of them found a positive effect. I mean, that would be much better.
Very good. So examine.com, very good. All right, last question. Any final words of wisdom for our audience you want to throw out that I haven't teed up effectively enough with the right question.
The human body is not like a battery, because just go out there and do as much just exercise, well, as much as you can, or as much as it's fun. But I think also just by practicing, you can get much better. And sometimes a challenge state can occur just by doing the same thing that has been threatening to you for a 10th time after being threatening 9 times before. I mean, sometimes you just need those negative experiences. And I think sometimes you can also take something away from a threat state. So I think it's important to grow after a maladaptive stress experience, like a threat state in a competition, and definitely focus on the development, on the growth, and not so much on the outcome of that one competition or the experience of that one threat state. So don't get lost in it, but rather try to use it for your good and try to think constructively.
Excellent. So engaging that self-reflection process after the competition or life event of whatever it might be, of saying, okay, how did I interpret it? Is that somewhat of what you're recommending there?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you can always think about the challenge and threat states before the motivated performance situation, but you can always think about them afterwards as well. And maybe, think about, okay, did I really accurately evaluate my resources and my demands? And if so, what can I work on? And if not, how can I pay attention to evaluate them better in the future?
Interesting. Very good. Well, Dr. Hayes, I really appreciate you joining us. How can folks stay in touch with you or follow your findings going forward? Do you have a Twitter account or an email you want to throw out for folks?
I have a ResearchGates account.
Perfect.
So you can find me as Adrian Hayes on there and track my scientific output there.
Excellent. Well, I really appreciate you joining us. So many insights on this stuff. I've covered my page with notes here, and we'll definitely get this out. And thanks again.
Yeah, thanks a lot for inviting me.
Such interesting insights and so applicable, both our own lives and our clients' lives. Did you catch that part about when to use motivational self-talk versus instructional self-talk? Fascinating. Thank you again to Dr. Adrian Heise. Great, great insights. One of the resources I haven't mentioned in a while is our recommended book list. These are not our books. These are just books that we've read, that we've used as our own resources. You can find all of them under the resources tab at catalystcoachinginstitute.com. People ask us all the time during the certification trainings or during the online CEU programs about additional reading. What else is out there? How can they build on what we're talking about? And so we put that list together and you can find it there. Thank you so much to all of you who support the podcast by sharing it with friends, posting positive reviews, and obviously sending us the encouraging emails you've been sending. We really, really appreciate it. If we can help you with anything related to coaching or your career plans, please feel free to contact us anytime at results@catalystcoachinginstitute.com. In the meantime, let's keep pursuing better, both in our own lives and helping those around us do the same. As much as the concept of best life gets tossed around in the wellness world, best, well, it can often feel out of reach. But better, that's just one step away, isn't it, folks? So what's my better today? Make it a great rest of your day, and I'll speak with you soon on the next episode of the Catalyst Health and Wellness Coaching Podcast.